Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Judith Vollmer. Judith Vollmer's most recent book of poetry, Reactor, was published in 2004 by the University of Wisconsin Press, was featured in the Los Angeles Times Book Review, and was a nominee for the National Book Critics Circle Award. Her other books include The Door Open to the Fire, awarded the Cleveland State Poetry Prize in 1997, and finalist honors for the Patterson Prize in 1999. Black Butterfly, limited edition, awarded the Center for Book Arts Chapbook Prize in 1997, and Level Green, the Brittingham Prize winner, published by Wisconsin in 1990. Vollmer has received fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts. Her essay on Baudelaire, The Stroll and Preparation for Departure, appears in the Cambridge Companion to Baudelaire, Cambridge University Press, 2006. Vollmer also co-edits the national poetry magazine, 5 AM. She teaches in the New England MFA program in poetry. Oh, and one other fact here. Judith Vollmer is a professor of poetry at the University of Pittsburgh at Greensburg and directed that program for a number of years. Hi, Jude. How you doing?
Hi. Good to see you. Good to be here.
It's always great to have you here. I've been trying to get you on this show for a long time, but you're hard to get. So this is a happy day.
It is, and congratulations on your Red Sugar.
Oh, thank you.
Terrific new book by Jan Beatty.
Okay, but this is about you today. So you're going to start with some new poems, I think, or you might read one or two from Reactor, your also a wonderful book published by Wisconsin. So your choice, whatever you want to start with.
Okay, I thought I'd read new poems. I'm still writing about the same subjects that I've always been devoted to, place primarily, love of place, family, story, voices, and lately what I've been trying to do in some of the new poems is work with different ways of perceiving sensory messages. And so the new work is about that, I think, whether it's coming through other voices or it's coming while daydreaming in one of my favorite places to wander around in, Frick Park. So I thought I'd actually open with a poem from that place. And it's the only poem I'll read from Reactor. It's called July Evening with Ancestors. And I think it's a good poem for sultry Pittsburgh on a September evening as well. July Evening with Ancestors. Narrow and green under the summer canopy, my daydream calls up a sea turtle dozing on my lap so I can study its shell, ancient model for the igloo. A nice idea in July. And a boy streaming the hard reverb of his black Stratocaster onto the quiet street. The hard, pure sound breaks the sauna air a little. And now a canal tinted and flavored by gardeners and cooks, taking smoke breaks and pausing to snip the wild mint. The canal darkens also, with hands slipping sandals from tired feet, and brightens at each footbridge with sconces, slender guides that light finger the shadows. This new one got written after I took my mother to D.C. to see the Mark Rothko panels that were commissioned by the Seagram Foundation for the Four Seasons Restaurant in New York. And midway through the commission, I think Rothko had mixed feelings about where they would be hung. Nevertheless, they were gorgeous tall panels. And my mother has macular degeneration. So one of the things that's happened is as her vision has dimmed, her hearing and sense of color almost as a physical thing has intensified. So the poem has two voices going on in it, the voice of the speaker, me, and the voice of the mother, which moves in and out of history and memory. So I'll try to pitch my voice a little higher as I read the mother part. I take my mother to see the Rothko panels. Her eyes are adjusting like heat sensors on low in the dim gallery. It's all touch, and she leads. Her thin arm steers down 4 steps, another 10 to the soft banquette. But we say bench and laugh at the old joke. Her mother, after a social call. And what did she give you? It was the Depression. Coffee, a roll, a bench to put my butt on. He must have painted these at night. In that house, when you said goodnight, you said sleep red, sleep white, depending on where you slept, the fire room, the white room. These look more like stains than paint. The fire room had soot for conservation. Soon as the roof tiles wore out on one side, they turned them over and nailed them back down. He must have painted these by night, in a dark room beamed by fire and stars to get the maroons and the oranges this warm. During windstorms, they said the house walked. It swayed like it was on springs, bending in the winds, and then it came back to its original position. She pulls us to breath distance of the canvas, so close we wash down in crimson and sienna, Rothko's Pompeii. He spiked his commission for the grand restaurant with something that will ruin the appetite of every son of a gun who ever eats in that room. Her mother's house on the banks of the Vistula was framed with willows and firs, more green stain than color, brushed on by world or weather. They used crossbars and sealed the beams with forest moss and later wool. Even the attic slats were shaped like sunbeams. In the white room, they had religious pictures painted on glass. They carved the sun and the rosette, a star, up near the roof. This next one I'll read in honor of Michael Worster, who will be reading soon in town and back from open heart surgery. And this is my homage to his quintessential compressed style, and it's called Bob Dylan Morning. And as in a lot of the newer things I'm working on, the Bob Dylan figure comes in as part ghost, part visitor outside my kitchen window. Bob Dylan Morning. Fresh bread and butter, I whisper to the cutting board and pin. I'm learning to bake in my late youth, while the international blood does and does not seep through the digital reports, and April splashes down onto birds for all seasons. A fence, refreshed with white paint, awaits the first smudge. This afternoon, a sliver of my paycheck is going to Chronicles, Volume 1, essential as the ductwork and new glasses I need. Forget the book, he calls, somewhere out in the yard. I crack the window. The water over here is 30 feet deep. His wool coat smell drifts apples and dogs and a fat gram of hash. The yeast is ready, but I have to waken it with a pinch of sugar. Now I work it into the flour and see chemistry help my poor skills. Put the black apron on over the white. You think you can do that?
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Judith Vollmer, reading some new poems, and also I think she will read some poems from her latest book, Reactor. I want to mention before we go on that Michael Worster is reading at Tay Cafe on September 11th. So, good to know. But I want to ask you about these messages that you're getting, or that people in your poems are getting. Seems like there are meetings between this world and another, and that often they take place in everyday places, you know, ordinary places, the kitchen. A lot happens in the kitchen in your books, in your poems. And in keeping with this idea of the atmospheric that seems so important in your work, it seems like there's a meeting of the earth and air, you know, at once. Does that make sense in any way to you?
Well, you know, Jan, that's one of my problems. this idea that bringing two places together, two impressions together, is always on my mind. And the next poem I thought I'd read is also started in a kitchen in Palermo. I was watching TV with my friends there, and every night there are death reports from Afghanistan, and there are public griefs right on television, much the way we watched body bags being delivered at Dover during the Vietnam War. And so the poem started with that strong impression that when I love the two cities I love most, Pittsburgh and Rome, and now I have friends in southern Italy as well, I'm struck by how antiseptic our culture still is about the war in Iraq. And unless you live close, have someone close, you don't see the public grief, and you don't hear the public grief in the same way. So kitchen, airspace, the distances, I think anybody who's a writer travels show up in this poem, I hope. And it's a bit longer than some of the others, but I thought I'd read it.
Yeah, go ahead.
So the speaker in this poem is standing outside the chain link at Dover Air Force Base, which is essentially sealed off. It's where the dead come in. And the speaker's also in Pittsburgh, walking outside her house near Frick Park and near the Homewood Cemetery there, and then traveling back in time to walking in the green space of childhood on the tarmac at Dover Air Force Base. The sodium vapor lights look down inside their columns of rain and light the hot pavement, sending its steam back up. Drops of oil and rain smeared by a truck, drops the size of dimes, liberties maybe, pure silver working nonstop, like eyes offering love, like me looking for something to focus on. A feather, a shoelace tip, a comb, a rusting stencil I find in a storm ditch. 1, 2, 3, 0, an honor guard of rain eyes, we want you to grieve. Miniaturists waiting for the jets, the only cameras blurred here. Under the scrims of grease in rainwater, you might catch a glimpse of something human or mechanical, simple acts of love and friendship, seeing the dead on a daily basis in their transport. Our tongue and soil twist themselves in a lost key. The dark and the quiet are going to have to be enough space for thinking. I had to sit out under the stars last night, accidental lockout on my porch, looking in, and I prepared to come here and see the runway, the hangar, all the empty parking spaces where TV trucks should be. I lost my key. I'd left the news on. The windows were sealed and shining. The evening star was blinking. My dead had left their soul traces onto the sidewalk. The dead show up no matter what. In the cemetery at Frick Park, you can look inside the little houses even the rich don't visit. Leaves and webs unswept, the Tiffany glass unpolished, and down the hill, endless rows of stones, another on another in a crooked wedding cake of white stones, high as row houses, black stones patinaed with soot and benzene, photos of the dead under glass. Milos said, we can't have Earth, can't even attain it in our dreams. What harm in coming here, seeing how and who we kill? I can't give anything but the old fable of the sun and the wind. Which is more powerful, the sun or the wind? Only the sun and not the wind can force a man to remove his coat. Only the eyes might see through the cinder layer to the clay level. The mineral kingdom digs into the elements inside out. What color is the reverse? There is no reverse. Only the living come to pick up their young coffins, dreaming and carrying green and yellow grass, rust and clear water. Now an eye shows me a leaf, almond-shaped with water droplets, bronze leaf, rinsed and leathery, stomping in creeks. Some of the boys did that, and the girls. Some made dishes from catalpa leaves and served flour meals on them and washed their hands with sassafras leaves after feeding their child families. The thought of boots in creek beds and leaf picnics and water taking the crisp top layer of the leaf, softening it. The thought of boot leather softened by rain, scratched by mud. Here on asphalt, having no one to greet and having no one to bury, bless my luck in this hour. The dead soften even under the shellacking and the metals and the censored grief.
Yeah, nice poem. And I really like the use of questions in that poem and the different forms of, you know, a statement, a sense of meditation, and then a really strong, you know, there's a question and then sometimes there's an answer given immediately in the poem. When we started talking, you said that you were looking into different ways of perceiving sensory messages. Historically in your work, you know, you've used asides, soliloquies, fragments of imagining. What do you feel is shifting in terms of form in your work?
I think maybe in before it felt easier for me to cast a kind of grand blame on something or on some them. Now I'm trying to pay more attention to my own complicities and ignorances maybe, and listen in a little harder and pay closer attention to direct testimony and experience and voices, and to listen to people a little more closely. It's funny because when I was in my 20s and I was a reporter, that's what I did for a living. I interviewed people and listened. And I think I'm sort of absorbing some of the education of that time in a different way, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. It makes sense because I was going to ask a question related to praise and investigation, because there's this sense of strong sense of investigation I keep feeling. And I was, you know, almost used the word reporting. But I again, there's always this doubling, but maybe doubling is not a good word. It seems like tripling, the quadruple. There's all these many voices, okay? But I always feel a lot of movement, you know. And I was thinking about it in terms of praise and investigation, you know, and in some poems it comes out as, you know, praise for the work or praise for the person getting up each day, praise for the soldier, whoever it might be. But simultaneously there's this investigation of, and there's always some green that comes in, like the human green landscape at the edges of these spaces, which is, you know, it seems like the picture is getting more and more complex in a good way, not in an overly complex way. But I imagine that must be more difficult to write these poems because of that, or is that not right?
Well, it's funny because I was talking to Peter Resick yesterday morning, and we were moaning about, gee, I have too many muses going on in my head right now. How do I focus in on the few voices that are most important to me right now? And that's part of the wonder of the American, sound space. And that's also part of the job of the poet, to go out and look around and literally investigate and take a train trip or a bus trip or a car trip or take a walk and get out and pay attention and not just sit in the room with, you know, the piles of texts that we all have access to.
Right. And all these voices flying around. I mean, it's like you don't want to just pull one in or pull two in. There's so many. But okay, how about more poems?
All right. Here's a poem about a dress, concealing itself and revealing itself as Pittsburgh. It's called New Black Dress. New black dress will wash to gray, green gray. I'll drape over my chair. Let me take another look at the translucent hem running the circumference of its black rhinestone trail. Last look before the rag bin, loose teeth, thin hair. But tonight belongs to her, new moon weave, driving the boulevard of the Allies at dusk, softest time on the planet, street lamps turning themselves on like relaxed insomniacs, while evening releases its green sugar and white oils. Her inky stitches track an arcade, her bell sleeves incline a bell and run up a staircase. I'm peering through a window, silver foiling a bridge. I slip through its cutwork beams, neckline to hem, easy and loose, inside the body of the shift, floating above the shift gears of the night rivers, where otters slide onto their backs in the deep Monongahela again, their eyelashes filtering silt from liquid, near from far, maybe a keyhole view of a deep black dress, holding another creature, also silk and fur and bone. Another poem of the woman artisan. Again, I'm trying to work with two places at once, and the poem begins here in the past and moves there, the here and there being the Monongahela River and the small village of Alcamo in Sicily. It's called The Mender's Two Lives. In a town along the Monongahela, the stratifications sort color, cord, and duck, hopsack, wool, and felt. Tiny bulbs on strings burn through the night, overhung by ladders she climbs to pluck, you imagine, another 1,001 stories from the sleeves of a coat. But she's counting and saving for passage over the sea to the white surface where she'll apply gold paint and transform a wall into lace. In the church of Alcamo, open the door. Someone has already left petals in a glass bowl in case you wish to scatter them, anointing the floor she walks, carrying her tools up toward the altar, the whole room gleaming in the early morning dark. Her paint, brush, hand, and breath press themselves into the leaf arcs and tongues so smooth she sings while she works, no distance between stitch and hand. I've been working also on a sequence of poems that are strangely titled my stick poems. I've been finding and picking up and throwing into the backseat of my car groups or bundles of sticks that are 8 inches to a foot long. And I think I'm calling them, hobo prayer sticks or something. So I'll read one of those. This one's called Sticks Laid Across a Field, and you'll hear the word gleaner in the poem, which is really an old-fashioned word and calls to mind those 19th century paintings from the French. But in fact, if you drive around the countryside in Pennsylvania or Vermont or any number of places, you'll see older folks gathering sticks, putting them in big brush piles, and so on. So the gleaner is a real person who I've seen and talked to, and he shows up in the poem. Sticks laid across a field. When my solitude is pleasure, I become a gliding thing that moves at will out the door and down the steps, onto asphalt, across the straight edge into the field, where at dusk I make out a thicket shaped like a big cat and find last night's storm drop these five fallen onto each other, forming a pentangle of wood for pencils or kindling, or the shape of a fallen star, burnt gray. These bear hundreds of holes I can't read. Whoever drilled the bark exposed the bronze underskin. Drought made the simple knots, and bitter saps pushed the tips into the inching forward motion tree limbs make overnight. No diviner would pick these up, but a gleaner would, and look for others, counting, stop counting, because hands become birds when lifting sticks. See that man leaning to his work. Each time he straightens up, you notice the light weight of a stick balancing his shoulders, since the skyward reach of a tree still lives in every twig, and the wood carries oxygen into his canvas sack. This one is situated up in the northwestern corner of Pennsylvania, up near the dam in the Allegheny Forest, where the Seven Nations Casino is slated to be built. So it's an elegy to that place where off and on since I was a kid, I've gone camping, and it's called Kinzua. The ground is wet and cold where we abandon ourselves to Alice Cooper and the Scorpions and set our tents in central fire pits circled by stones. We bring the good knife from the Subaru's side door compartment and 2 days' food, tarps, wine, and bread. Breeze sifts through pine. I adjust the screen over the fire, brew the Yukon fine grind, and roll a celebratory and elegiac joint while late frost begins its sweat melt under the Aries sun. And something gray and unlabeled by clouds, sky, opens at the edge of the water. Skunk cabbage switchblades release their horrible, sweet smell. Sharp smoke draws wavy lines around our space so we don't see the bobcat slip over the berm and climb the ridge, accompanied by ghosts, tamping messages deeper into the bulldozed trails. We're fireside early, solemn and exhilarated up here in the last of it.
You know, we're out of time. It went too quickly. It's the poetry of Judith Vollmer, reading some new work and also some work from her book, Reactor. Thanks so much, Jude.
Thanks, Jan. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment newsweekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Helen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Amy Sutton, Michelle Stoner, and Ben Cole. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.